Welcome to How to Save Your Life. How to Save Your Life is produced with the assistance of the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Your host is Dr. Philip Stieg, Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Cancer. It is a dreadful word to hear when it is said to you or a loved one. This evening, you will meet with Dr. Lewis B. Harrison, Clinical Director of Continuum Cancer Centers and Chairman of Radiation Oncology at Beth Israel Medical Center. Dr. Harrison will outline reasons for hope in managing cancer. People do live longer lives and have a better quality of life. Please stay with us. Welcome again this evening to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip E. Stieg, Professor and Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Medical College, Cornell University, and New York Presbyterian Hospital. It is my distinct pleasure this evening to have an honored guest, Dr. Lewis B. Harrison, who is the Clinical Director of Continuum Cancer Centers of New York and Chairman of Radiation Oncology at Beth Israel Medical Center and St. Luke's and Roosevelt's Hospital in New York. In addition to this, he is Professor of Radiation Oncology at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He is past president and president of many prestigious organizations within the field of radiation oncology, and in 2007 he will become the president of the most preeminent body in that organization. It is a distinct pleasure to have Dr. Harrison with us today.
That's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Lou, I think that most people, when they hear radiation oncologists, probably get a chill going up and down their spine. Can you explain to us what radiation therapy is and what a radiation oncologist does?
Sure. I mean, radiation therapy is one of the oldest and probably one of the most widely used cancer treatments. Most people don't realize that the majority of cancer patients at some point in their course of treatment get radiation therapy as either the definitive treatment, the primary treatment, or as part of a number of treatments. And radiation oncologists are the physicians who specialize in delivering radiation therapy and are a key part of the treatment team of the various cancer specialists that manage cancer and that help patients through this, what can be a very challenging problem.
Is radiation always used for only cancer, or is it ever used for some kind of what we would call benign or non-cancerous things?
Well, when people didn't know better decades and decades and decades ago, it was used for acne and arthritis and all kinds of crazy things. But nowadays, the overwhelming majority of patients who get radiation therapy are cancer patients. Mm-hmm. There are, however, some benign tumors and some benign situations where radiation in very low doses or in very moderate doses can be effective. And so a few percent, I would say, of patients that get radiation do not have cancer.
So I think a lot of people get confused when they hear the word cancer versus benign. You know, when you as a radiation oncologist use those terms, what do you mean? You know, so what should the listeners be looking for?
Well, you know, cancer involves a disease that usually starts out as what people think of as a tumor, which is a mass or an abnormal growth. And the thing that makes cancer different from other problems is that this tumor, the cells in the tumor, can spread to other parts of the body. It could spread to regions near where the cancer started. And by spreading to other parts of the body and by affecting vital organs can ultimately lead to the death of the patient, obviously. And that's the major concern with cancer, is trying to prevent cancer from causing the death of the patient. Benign tumors or benign growths don't have that capability of spreading to other parts of the body. They tend to be, they tend to stay in the area where they start. They can grow and cause some problems in that area, but they tend not to spread, and they don't threaten the life of the patient.
So let's take it. We'll later on in the show, we'll be talking a little bit more about the various types of benign and cancerous tumors that you treat. You've been in radiation oncology for, over 20 years. How have you seen this field change? I think we all have these pictures of anemic-looking people walking around without hair. Is that still the story, or
Well, no. I mean, some patients, yes, but the exciting thing about radiation oncology is the tremendous improvements in cancer care that's occurred over the last 10 or 20 years. There are well over 5 million, probably over 8 million patients in the United States that are cancer survivors, that are alive and functioning well. The five-year survival rates for cancer have never been higher. And so there's been an explosion of technology and an explosion of wisdom that have allowed us to detect cancers at an earlier stage, treat them in ways that are less aggressive and that are less devastating to patients, and leave patients intact, leave patients leading normal lives, and giving them great hope for improved survival. So if you look at an average cancer patient that comes into the doctor's office today in 2006, compared to, let's say, 20 years ago when I was starting, patients generally walk in today with cancers that are detected earlier, and for whom there are treatment strategies that are available to them that are less invasive, that are less prone to make them sick, less prone to devastate their function, and more prone to leave them A, cured, and B, as intact as they were even before they had the cancer. So there's been a tremendous movement in that area, which is very exciting. And in fact, I think makes most of us in the treatment that live and work in the world of treating cancer very, very enthusiastic about where we are and where we're going.
During that answer, you said something about five-year survival rate. When you deal with patients with cancers, is that for you the cure? If I can tell somebody they've got 100% survival at 5 years, I've cured you?
Well, you know, it's different from cancer to cancer. I mean, there are some cancers in whom if it's going to come back, it'll come back within the first year or two. And so for that cancer, a two-year survival rate may be tantamount to a cure. But for cultural reasons and perhaps for other reasons that have not necessarily a lot to do with medical facts, in the lay public and in our parlance and in our discussions, we generally talk about five-year survival as a very, very good benchmark as to whether or not that patient is likely to be cured.
I want to get back to the technology question. You know, for those of us that are addicted to either House, and then there was that brief show that was on 3 Pounds, they showed a lot of technology. And I have, in radiation oncology, I have these images of arms swinging around and developing, you know, invisible rays to the patient. Has that been occurring? And what's out there for the patients? Is it easier for a patient now than it was 20 years ago?
Well, the technology has exploded, and the effectiveness and the accuracy and every aspect of radiation therapy has just entered into a new world in the last 5 to 10 years compared to the way it used to be. When we talk about radiation therapy or any cancer treatment, I often tell patients that it's like controlled violence. If you take a knife and cut somebody on the street, you'd go to jail. If you gave somebody radiation therapy in a willy-nilly way, you can harm them tremendously. But the skill sets that are available nowadays of the physicians that do these treatments, whether it be surgery or radiation or chemotherapy, we are getting more and more able to focus the treatment in ultra-precise ways so that we kill tumor cells and in an increasingly sophisticated way can protect the normal cells near the cancer and not kill those. So, for example, if you have a cancer near your spine, you want to kill the cancer, but you want to keep the spine intact, we have ways of doing that with the targeting devices and the treatment delivery devices and techniques that are available today. And that's really the whole difference today compared to years and years ago, is our ability to identify exactly where the cancer is, to target that with very sophisticated radiation therapy technology, to actually deliver the treatment and verify as you're delivering the treatment that it's going in the right place and that it's not going where you don't want it to do. And you're doing all of that in a patient who's awake and who doesn't feel a thing. And that's a very attractive set of circumstances.
Just for people out there that may have just gotten diagnosed today, outline what's the process for them. I mean, like you said, it's they come in, and they go home the same day. What happens in a on the average day of a patient coming in for radiation therapy?
Well, it starts with an initial visit with the doctor, and the diagnosis of cancer has been made, the various treatment options are talked about, and every cancer patient should explore all of their options and make sure they're really satisfied that the option that they've selected gives them the highest chance of being cured, the greatest chance of being functionally intact at the end of treatment. And once all of that's done and the decision is made to use radiation, then before the treatment starts, there is a process which we call treatment planning, which is a process whereby we take the patient, lay them down on a table, take some x-rays, do some CAT scans, and using the imaging techniques that are available today, reconstruct their tumor in 3 dimensions, maybe even 4 dimensions, maybe even 5 dimensions. And I'll tell you later if you want what those different dimensions are. But analyzing anatomically exactly where their tumor is, exactly the relationship of their tumor to the surrounding normal organs, and then what we do is sit and figure out the best way to direct radiation beams into that patient, going at complex angles with different beam intensities and different beam shapes, so as to accomplish the goal of depositing a very, very high dose of radiation directly into the tumor, but at the same time give as low an amount of radiation to the organs around the tumor so that they're not damaged at the same time that we're trying to kill the tumor and cure the patient.
A little bit earlier, you referred to the fact that we're seeing or you're seeing patients earlier on. I'm presuming that's because primary care doctors and internists are much more willing to order a test nowadays since it's not very invasive. How has technology, and by that I mean the advance of MRI technology, magnetic resonance imaging, CAT scanning with these new, 64, 120 slice things, does that affect you in terms of your planning, and does it have a positive effect on what you do?
Oh, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, the treatment machines that we use nowadays to deliver radiation therapy oftentimes have CAT scanners on the machine. So this is what happens. A patient goes into the room where we're going to give them the radiation that they need. We want to make sure the radiation is going into the right place. Nowadays, and this is very new, and it's still in, I would say, the investigational stages, but with the patient lying on the table, just before we actually give them the radiation, we can, in a matter of seconds, do a CAT scan of the patient lying there on the table, on the treatment machine, exactly in the position that they're going to be in when they get the treatment, and look at that CAT scan real time, verify that the tumor is exactly where we thought it was, that the beams are going to go directly into that tumor, and before we treat the patient, with that kind of real-time verification, use those scans to help ensure absolute complete accuracy of our treatment.
And the implications when you say, number one, when you're saying real time, you're meaning as you're doing it, you can confirm that, I presume.
Right, of course.
The implications of that high-end accuracy is what?
No damage or minimal damage to the surrounding organs, maximal damage to the tumor, and many times this kind of accuracy allows us actually to give higher doses of radiation than we used to be able to give because we're so confident that the radiation is going to the tumor and not to the normal tissues next to it that we can give higher doses of radiation to many tumors and by giving higher doses hopefully increase the cure rates.
I presume we're relating to or what you're leading me up to is something when one looks at your website, we find out that you're extremely interested in organ function preservation. Is that what you're referring to when you're talking about this precision?
Yeah, I mean, imagine a patient that has a cancer of a vital organ like the tongue or the voice box or near the eye or in the lower part of their rectum where an operation might imply a colostomy or losing their tongue or losing their voice box or losing their eye. I mean, these are devastating alternatives for patients to consider.
We're going to have to take a short break. We'll be right back to How to Save Your Life with Dr. Lou Harrison. And he's going to tell us how we can save our organs with radiation therapy. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm delighted to be with Dr. Lewis B. Harrison, Clinical Director of Continuum Cancer Centers of New York and Chairman of Radiation Oncology at Beth Israel Medical Center. Before we left, we were talking about a concept in radiation oncology called organ function preservation. Lou, could you go into that a little bit more detail? What is it, and how is it relevant to radiation treatments?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we were talking about imagining a situation where you had a tumor in your tongue or near your eye or in your voice box or in the rectum, where you might have to lose your rectal function and get a colostomy or lose your tongue or lose your voice box. These are devastating thoughts for a patient. And what a horrible situation to be in, to have to make a choice between functions that are so vital to your day-to-day life and being who you are on the one hand, and yet on the other hand trying to preserve your life by eradicating and getting rid of the cancer that's there. And so there has been a great interest in not only in radiation oncology, but in medical oncology, chemo, and in surgery, in trying to treat cancers throughout the body in ways that don't destroy the function of the organ that the cancer has arisen in. And so for nowadays, for example, for a patient who has a cancer in the back of the tongue, way in the back of the tongue, called the base of the tongue, in the old days, an operation to take that cancer out would have meant the patient would look different, the patient would not be able to speak normally, the patient would not be able to swallow normally. But nowadays, with very, very focused forms of radiation therapy, combinations of external radiation treatments like we spoke about earlier, and something called implants or brachytherapy, where we actually take the patient to the operating room, and when we put them to sleep, instead of taking the tumor out, we actually put radiation into the tongue, and it stays there for a few days and then comes out. But for the few days the radiation stays in there, very, very high doses of radiation delivered directly into the tumor. And this is a way for us to get very high doses of radiation into a tumor, and the patient gets a very high cure rate and doesn't lose their tongue. A patient with prostate cancer might be treated with a similar kind of implant where permanent seeds are placed in their prostate, which delivers radiation at high doses to their prostate and avoids a major operation that could have an impact on their ability to have an erection, their ability to urinate normally, and things of that sort. And so it's a very, very attractive initiative in all of these different cancer specialties to invent treatments that eradicate the cancer but don't destroy the organ where the cancer has arisen in. So nowadays, women don't have to lose their breast for breast cancer. Patients don't have to lose their voice box, most patients, if they have cancer of the voice box. And if you go throughout the body, the examples of that are all over the place.
We had another well-known breast surgeon on the radio show, and I'm hearing the same thing from you as well. Patients are doing better. It's with the technology that we have nowadays, they're not as injured by the treatments that we have to give them to preserve both the quality of their life and the duration of their life.
Absolutely. And there's another point to this that's often overlooked. If the consequence of finding a cancer in your breast is losing your breast, you know what used to happen? Women would feel a lump in their breast, and they wouldn't do anything about it, and they'd let it get bigger. And only when it became a significant size would they go to the doctor and do something about it. And that's a shame. But knowing that you don't have to lose your breast, knowing that if you detect a cancer early, you can be treated in a way that preserves the organ and preserves the function, that actually is an incentive for patients to come in earlier and get treated, you know, at a much earlier time.
Part of what I was thinking about as you were answering this series of questions was, I'm a layperson. I walk in and I all of a sudden start hearing these fancy words, radiation oncology, minimally invasive surgery, brachytherapy. You know, I don't know what they mean. My head's spinning. How do I go about choosing the right kind of doctor, the right team of doctors? Is it better to go to multiple institutions? What do you recommend in that scenario?
Well, you know, patients with cancer have a very, very important set of decisions to make. Obviously, there's no cancer patient for whom these decisions won't become the most important decisions perhaps that they've ever made in their lives. The decision number one is, what kind of treatment should I take? And the decision number two is, who should I allow to do it to me? And these are very important decisions. So what I like to tell patients is they should get multiple opinions. And I also think it's usually helpful to get multiple opinions from different kinds of specialists. I think you shouldn't see, if you have prostate cancer, 4 different radiation oncologists or 5 different urologists. If you're going to get multiple opinions about treatment, you should hear about the surgical options, you should hear about the radiation options, and make a decision having heard from the various specialists involved. So get opinions from various specialists, and also get opinions from multiple people. Once you've synthesized that, the facts are today that the majority of cancer patients will get more than one treatment. It's generally not just surgery or just radiation or just chemotherapy. It's usually a combination of these treatments put together in a very strategic way. And so patients have to organize in their mind the treatment team, the group of people that are going to deliver this treatment. And this team needs to work together in a seamless and a coordinated way to give the patient the best results. So a breast cancer patient should see a surgeon, a radiation, and a medical oncologist. And similarly, for most other cancers, see all the members of the team and choose a team that does this all the time, that has good results, and in equally as important a way that you connect with personally. Because the relationship between a cancer patient and their treatment team is very personal. It's very intimate, and it needs to be perfectly comfortable.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the most important points that you make is, you know, this is different than having a hernia repair or getting a cosmetic procedure. This is something where you have a long-lasting relationship. And that's what I wanted to ask next is it important, you see one surgeon, he or she has an opinion about being aggressive surgically, you see the radiation oncologist, and he or she says, "Now I can do this with radiation first." Hence my question, is it best to have a single team where, they've all worked together for X number of years, have kind of a common philosophy, have a common experience, and they can look you in the eye and tell you, this is what we have found to be good for patients with your specific disease.
Yeah, that is really important. And I think that's a very, very important thing for patients to remember. And especially for all the reasons that you described, plus the fact that if you have a group of people that does this all the time, that do it together routinely, and that have published good results and that have achieved good results, that's a very comforting thing for a cancer patient. And that's the kind of environment that serious illness should be dealt with.
So who kind of holds this together? Is it you? Is it the oncologist? Is it the surgeon? How in your group have you experienced this with patients?
Well, it's the team, and it's almost like a relay race where you have a passing of the baton. There's a team of people, and the first guy runs around the track, and then the second guy runs around the track, and then the third guy runs around the track. And sometimes two guys run around the track together, because sometimes you're going to get surgery and radiation at the same time, or chemotherapy and radiation at the same time. And so the dynamic of the team and the functionality of the team is really very, very important. In some situations, one of the treatments are going to be a more dominant part of the treatment, so the person doing that is probably going to have a long and a greater role. But in the majority of situations, it isn't a hierarchy. It's more like a team working together. And instead of one of the doctors being in control, more and more nowadays, the patients are in control. And we're all equal members of this effort.
Why don't we comment a little bit about that? Many patients come into doctor's offices now with a stack of papers 3 feet high because the internet is so available. Do you think that that's good for them? Does it confuse them?
It can be a humbling experience. I've seen patients come in with papers that I wrote 15 years ago, and I forgot what I said. patients are more well-informed. They ask better questions. And I think that that's a good thing. And I think that if patients don't come in as well-informed as other patients do, some patients have less information, I think we should give them more information. So I think information's important, it's good, and the more information, the better.
You were talking a little bit about the team, and we kind of put the limelight on the surgeon, the oncologist, and the radiation oncologist. there's a heck of a lot more of a team behind the scenes that the patient doesn't always see, and it relates a lot to the technology. Can you go into that a little bit?
Oh, sure. I mean, every patient that gets radiation therapy, there's a team of physicists that work with the radiation oncologists to help design each radiation beam that's being used to treat them. A patient that's being treated with radiation to a tumor in the neck or anywhere in the body may have 10 or 15 different radiation beams of different shapes entering and exiting their body at different angles with different intensity, with different shape, and all of these with precision accuracy. And you need detailed physics expertise and mathematical expertise and what we call dosimetry expertise, which is measuring the actual dose that you deliver, to ensure that every aspect of that process is done with pinpoint accuracy. And so I have a picture in my office of a patient around the entire team of people that was involved in her care. And when you look at the radiation oncologist and a resident and a nurse practitioner and the nurse and the physicist and the dosimetrist, the nutritionist, the dietitian, and all of the people involved, there could be 10 or 20 people involved in the care of one patient who's getting radiation therapy.
When you talk about precision, I mean, what are you talking about? An eighth of an inch?
Millimeters.
Millimeters.
Millimeters. Sometimes a millimeter. Sometimes we will take a patient off the table, realign them, rescan them, and make sure it's right because of a millimeter or 2 millimeters.
And the average patient goes through how many treatments?
It depends, but most patients about six weeks plus or minus.
6 weeks, and that's every day, five days a week.
But there are some patients that get what we call stereotactic radiosurgery. That's one large radiation treatment for a brain tumor or for a tumor someplace else in the body. Another patient may get a fewer number of very large treatments. So it really varies from patient to patient and from different parts of the body.
But each one of those therapies are accurate to less than 1 millimeter.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Earlier in the talk, you were referring to something about, you know, the five dimensions, and I presume that has something to do with the accuracy. What do you mean by being able to see something in the fifth dimension?
Well, it's like a song, right? It's like a musical song. Well, the three dimensions are obvious. I mean, you know, the length, the width, and the height. But put a tumor in the chest, and patients breathe, and as the patients breathe in and out, that tumor is moving up and down, and so that tumor, from the point of view of a radiation machine that we are using to send beams to treat that tumor is a target. And in fact, if a patient is breathing and that tumor is moving up and down, that tumor is a moving target. And so we have to be smart enough to know how the patient is breathing and to modulate the movement of the radiation beam to take care of that breathing cycle. And so that's a dimension that we call sometimes the fourth dimension, when the tumor itself is a moving target because of breathing or because of other factors in the body. You know, the fifth dimension is a little bit more vague, but it gets into the biology of the tumor. What is the molecular makeup of the tumor? And how is that molecular makeup changing throughout the course of treatment? So when you start treatment on the first day, you have a tumor in place. But 5 weeks into the radiation, you've done damage to that tumor. That tumor is a biologically different tumor than it was the first day you treated them. What we are looking at nowadays is something called adaptive radiation therapy, which means that our treatments have to adapt biologically from the beginning to the middle to the end of treatment to adapt for the biological changes in the composition of the tumor.
Give me an example then of an adaptation.
Well, one adaptation is, let's say a patient starts out with a tumor in the neck that measures 6 inches. And we give that patient radiation therapy and chemotherapy based upon a treatment plan that we designed at the very beginning. 4 weeks later, that 6-inch tumor may be 1 inch. That's not the same tumor. And the cells that are in that 1 inch may be of a different biological makeup because there are cells that have survived the first several weeks of radiation. And so the treatment that we give at that point from just a common sense point of view, should be different than the treatment that we started out with 5 weeks earlier. And also, the size of the area that we treat probably should be different, because 6 inches is one size, and 1 inch is another size. And so we have to adapt the size, the anatomy, and oftentimes the biology. Now, this is a completely new area, and we don't know how to do this yet. This is something we're trying to figure out and trying to learn. But this area of adaptive radiotherapy becomes possible with some of the technologies that we have today. And I think we'll take radiation therapy to yet the next level, because these adaptations themselves will probably be able to enhance the cure rates.
I think a lot of people have images of the American automobile being constructed along the assembly line with these moving arms coming in. As you were talking about being able to adapt to the moving tumor within the lungs, is that what we have now? These beams that are, you know, they're directed, and you can see the little micro fluctuations in the radiation beam?
Yeah, and you have patients that may be set up with various straps or various sensors on their chest, and so the movement of their chest with when you breathe in and when you breathe out, with inspiration and expiration, the movement of the chest is known to the beam. And so once we lock in the movement of the chest for the breathing of the patient with the movement cycle of the beam, you can actually have the beam turn on and off only when the tumor moves into a certain range where the beam is going. And so it's called respiratory gating, and that's the fancy term for it, but it basically means turning the radiation beam on and off depending upon the moment that the tumor appears directly in the target of the beam.
And that doesn't affect the dose of radiation that they get. I mean, that's also corrected for, correct?
Yeah, it doesn't affect the dose to the tumor, but what it does do is it allows the lung around the tumor to get less dose.
So that relates back then to this preservation?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that allows you to give the tumor a higher dose because you're not damaging the lung, and that leads you to the possibility of a higher tumor control rate. And there is a very exciting new area of experimentation going on now with very, very small lung cancers, which have been traditionally treated by opening the chest and removing them, or removing them with minimally invasive, or, you know, an operation that is not as it's not as invasive as putting a big scar on someone's chest. There are now technologies and capabilities to use these techniques of radiation that I've just described and actually treat small lung tumors without surgery, and only with a course of these of several high dose radiation treatments given with these techniques that I've described. And the preliminary results, although it's still experimental, the preliminary results suggest that the cure rates may be just as high for many patients, not all, for many patients with no surgery at all. And so these are the kinds of advances that are becoming possible.
Are there any drugs out there that you can give that will enhance the effectiveness of radiation?
Absolutely. Many chemotherapy drugs, drugs that are traditionally given as chemotherapy drugs for cancer, work very, very well with radiation. And in fact, many of these drugs have been shown in clinical studies to improve the results of radiation significantly. So for certain cancers of the head, neck, and throat area, giving a drug called cisplatin, which is a chemotherapy drug with radiation, has been shown to give better outcomes than just radiation by itself. There are also a new class of drugs called targeted drugs. You know, we've been talking about radiation and targeting the radiation to the tumor. But chemotherapy drugs have evolved into the same concept of using what we call targeted agents, which, because of their immunological properties and because of their chemical properties, these drugs seek out cancer cells, and they go directly to cancer cells, damage the cancer cells with minimal to no damage to good cells. And so that kind of targeting is a very, very powerful tool.
We're going to have to take another short break. Please stay with me and Dr. Lewis B. Harrison to talk about how he's going to cure your cancer without even an incision. Thank you. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip B. Stieg, and I'm again delighted to be with Dr. Lewis B. Harrison, Clinical Director of Continuum Cancer Centers of New York and Chairman of Radiation Oncology at Beth Israel Medical Center and St. Luke's and Roosevelt Hospitals in New York City. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about drugs, chemicals that we can give patients to help improve the effectiveness of the radiation therapy. Where is that field going?
Well, it's exploding, and it's exploding at different rates in different parts of the body. But let me give you an example. A patient of mine, a very, very wonderful guy, when we saw him for the first time, he had a cancer way in the back of the tongue, as we were talking about earlier, encroaching on his voice box. And he had a big lump of cancer in his neck where this thing had spread. And he had been told that he needed to have his tongue removed, his voice box removed, the lymph nodes of his neck taken out, and then hope for the best. And we treated him on one of these programs that we've talked about earlier with organ and function preservation. And because the chemotherapy or the drug therapy has really come a long way, we used chemotherapy with radiation. And so this patient had a combination of chemotherapy and radiation therapy. And by the end of the chemo and the radiation, the tumor was gone. And we completed his treatment with an implant where we put the radiation seeds into the tongue. They stayed there for a few days and came out. And it's been about 11 years now. And this patient is a professor at a local university. He speaks normally. He swallows normally. And it had not been for this kind of treatment, this guy's professional life would have been over. And the issue here was using chemotherapy along with the radiation, because I don't think that this result could have been achieved by radiation by itself. And having these drugs that we can sometimes give with radiation that enhances the effects of radiation gives us a better outcome, and it gives us a better chance to provide patients like this with, you know, getting their old life back.
Earlier you were talking about how you started off with a 6-inch tumor, you hit it with some radiation, it turned into a 1-inch tumor, and you implied that the biology of that tumor changes. Are there cases where the radiation makes the tumor worse? It makes a worse cancer?
Well, you know, one of the reasons why we don't give radiation to people that don't have cancer for the overwhelming majority of the time is that the truth of the matter is that if you give somebody radiation, there is a tiny, tiny chance that 15, 20 years from now, that radiation that you give them could cause another cancer. It is a tiny, tiny chance. It's less than 1%. And, of course, when you're giving a patient radiation for cancer, the benefits of the treatment for the cancer they have far outweigh this tiny, tiny risk. And so it makes sense to do the treatment.
I also wanted to change paths here a little bit, and it was something we were talking about during the break, this concept of complementary medicine. What is it, and how do you feel about it?
We joke with patients that complementary medicine, when patients ask, what do I think about complementary medicine? I always tell them, you can tell us we're doing a good job anytime you want throughout the course of treatment. Compliments are great. But complementary medicine is just that. It's doing things that add to the traditional treatment that have the potential to make the traditional treatment better. And I think one important distinction that's very, very important for the listeners to understand is that complementary medicine isn't a substitute for traditional cancer therapy, but it is hopefully something that can help make traditional cancer therapy either work better or become less uncomfortable. So some of the things that we're interested in at our center and some of the things that we're looking at are things like therapeutic touch. Therapeutic touch is a fancy way of saying massage, but there's a science to this. And therapeutic touch may significantly decrease anxiety levels, stress levels. It may significantly reduce a patient's need for pain medication, so you reduce the side effects of the pain medication. And by making them less anxious, more comfortable, they become more compliant with treatment. A treatment becomes less of an ordeal for them. They can get through treatment easier, and that's something that we're looking at in a very serious way. Things like acupuncture may be very helpful in reducing discomfort and in helping patients with certain side effects. There have been studies that have shown that music therapy if a patient has surgery and they are a part of a program where they're getting music therapy, that they may in fact need less pain medication after surgery and in fact may go home from the hospital sooner. So these kinds of things, which are starting to become known because different places are studying it, are things that physicians should not poo-poo and dismiss as being silly. Patients are interested in this. There is a real legitimate effort to try to study these things, and I think we have to listen to our patients, embrace these ideas, and try to learn more about it.
As long as they stay with the conventional standard therapy, is there any downside to doing it?
No. As a matter of fact, patients generally emerge from treatment more satisfied, less uncomfortable. And there's another important thing about this, Phil, that I think is very, very important to cancer patients, or to any patient. There is no time in your life that a person is more dependent upon others than when they're being treated for a medical problem, certainly for cancer. Here you are in a situation where you're meeting strangers, they're doing very, very unusual and scary things to you. You don't understand it completely, and you feel as if you've lost control.
And that's the important point I wanted to make, is that, you know, even in my practice, I see the major thing, it's not so much the cancer, it's the loss of control.
Yes.
And how do you help your patient through that?
Yeah, and loss of control is huge, and it just compounds the fright. But embracing something like complementary medicine and giving the patients the power to take a piece of their care and do what makes them comfortable and take a piece of their care that's totally geared towards making them feel better, that's an enormously important thing for patients. And doctors should embrace that because it will help their patient get better quicker.
I think it's important for the listeners to know that, you know, medicine attracts a certain kind of a person, and then subspecialties of medicine attract certain kinds of people. And I think that by listening to you on the radio, they can feel the energy and positive waves in your voice. This is a tough field. I mean, you're dealing with people that, like you talked about, the man with the lump in the back of his throat, and they were talking about taking out his voice box and his ability to communicate. How did you get into medicine, and how did you pick this field?
Well, I got into medicine, you know, because I just thought medicine was a fascinating way to spend your life. I think it's a challenge to encounter complicated problems. You meet lots of interesting people at a strategic moment in their life, and you get to try to help them. And I think that the advances that are being made in medicine make medicine a very exciting profession. This year is completely different than 5 years ago, and 5 years from now will be completely different from today. It's always changing, and keeps you on your toes.
And then how did you end up picking radiation oncology?
Well, I mean, I was interested in cancer. I was probably forever moved without realizing it by a child that grew up several houses away from me in Brooklyn, who, when we were young, developed a tumor, lost his leg, and ultimately died. And I knew the word cancer at a very young age because of my friendship with this child. And I guess that stayed with me. And I was always hit by the importance of cancer and what it can do to someone and what it can do to a family. And that interest stayed with me through medical school. And I did a couple of electives in medical school, and it confirmed my interest. And here I am.
So we were talking about a little bit earlier. Do you think that part of your optimism with patients is because of your optimism in the advancements of the field? Is it the complementary therapy? Is it a combination of all these things that helps you be upbeat and get up in the morning so that you can be positive with them?
Well, you know, part of my optimism is knowing that for so many cancers nowadays, we really can provide terrific outcomes for patients. Unfortunately, the reality is for a lot of other cancers, we can't. And depending upon...
What are the cancers that you're upbeat about now?
Well, you know, prostate cancer, we've come a long way. Head and neck cancer, we've come a long way. Breast cancer, we've come a long way. You know, certainly skin cancers, we've come a long way. I'm not talking about melanoma, but I'm talking about other kinds of skin cancers. So I think we've come a long way in a lot of cancers in terms of doing the things I've said, curing you and leaving you intact. There are other cancers where, despite tremendous efforts, we just haven't come as far as we should, and we need to do a lot more. And for those cancers, it's hard to be optimistic, but we have to keep trying.
And is that where you use the complementary therapy in that to try to help both the patient and the family?
Sure. I mean, complementary medicine, I think, has a potential role for any cancer patient, but certainly for a patient in whom their outcome doesn't look like it's going to be good, and it's a real uphill climb. Anything that you can do to make that journey more comfortable or keep that person in greater control, I think it's a very, very important thing.
Earlier you referred to this thing called head and neck cancer. That's kind of a general term. Can you, number one, what causes it? What's the, you know, what do we need to do to avoid it? What kind of behaviors are bad? What are good? And then we'll go through how you treat it.
Well, I mean, the most common cancer in the head and neck area is a skin cancer in the head and neck. And the most important way to avoid that is to wear sunscreen and avoid overexposing your skin to the sun. And so that's probably the best way to avoid head and neck cancer in terms of skin cancer. I know I'm an avid golfer, and I put lots of sunscreen on before I go out and play golf.
Everybody thinks they're not going to be hurt. How prevalent is this?
Skin cancer?
Yeah.
Oh, it's just, I mean, we don't know how prevalent it is because there aren't detailed records of how many skin cancers there are, but there is no question that it's the most common human cancer. It's almost everywhere in society. And if you go down to Florida or to the Southwest or areas of significant sun exposure, it's enormous. If you go to a hospital in Australia, and I've been to some of the hospitals in Melbourne and Sydney, some of the most common cancers they treat are skin cancers. So, you know, sunscreen is very important. But for the traditional cancers of the head and neck, which are the mouth, the throat, the voice box, the sinuses, the nose, and these areas in the head and neck, it's really exposure to smoking. Smoking is the big culprit. Alcohol is also a major culprit. And smoking and drinking are the two major causes of head and neck cancer. There may also be some viruses, some very exotic viruses that we're discovering may be a part of the problem in some people. But don't smoke, and certainly don't abuse alcohol, and your chances of getting head and neck cancer are pretty small.
What about chewing tobacco?
That's horrible. And you know, the U.S. Congress has had lots of hearings about this. And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes you see athletes on TV chewing tobacco, and kids are motivated by trying to copy their favorite athlete. And so I think athletes have the potential to really help kids and help people get the right impression, because chewing tobacco, some of the worst cancers I have seen are in young people who chew tobacco. And there's no question that that's a major, major culprit.
So a person, what are they going to have? Bleeding from the gums? They're going to have a lump that they all of a sudden notice?
They might feel a lump in their neck. They may feel a lump in their throat when they swallow. If they have a cancer near their voice box, they may become hoarse, or their voice may change. They may develop pain. They may notice a little bleeding. You know, these are the things that they would usually notice.
So who do they go to? Do they go to their family doctor? Do they go to a ear, nose, and throat doctor? Do they come to you?
Yeah, well, no. I think a radiation oncologist would probably not be the first place they think to come, but usually a patient with a sore throat or some of these changes would probably go to their family doctor. And ultimately, if whatever they have doesn't look like it's a cold or a sore throat or something simple, they'd probably wind up with a ear, nose, and throat doctor who would evaluate them. And then if they have a cancer, the question will become, well, what do we do about the cancer? And then we go back to the discussion that we had earlier, is the importance of seeing, you know, the head and neck surgeon and the radiation oncologist and the various other specialist medical oncologists that might be involved in their care.
And is it now, because we have better MRIs, better CAT scans, you're seeing them a lot earlier, and you can either use a combination of treatments gives you better results?
Well, I think, you know, the best example of early detection nowadays are prostate cancer and breast cancer, because PSA, which is a commonly done blood test, has made the diagnosis of prostate cancer a very, very early diagnosis. Most patients nowadays, advanced prostate cancer is so rare nowadays because PSA picks them up early. Breast imaging with mammography has caused a significant shift in finding breast cancers before you can feel them, when they're just visible on the x-ray. And so they're treated at a much earlier stage. So I think that breast cancer and prostate cancer are two examples of early detection. Head and neck cancer, not as much.
So what's the let's go down the breast and prostate pathway. 20 years ago, I had a number of my dad's friends die from prostate cancer. What percentage of people actually die from prostate cancer now?
A pretty small percentage. A pretty small percentage. The mortality from prostate cancer has gone down significantly, and it's mainly because of early detection. Most patients are diagnosed because their PSA is elevated. Usually they have relatively early stage disease, and usually a patient is available to, or eligible, I should say, for a very localized and oftentimes not a very invasive treatment.
And that's also true then for breast cancer as well?
Yeah, I mean, breast cancer, the majority of patients nowadays are detected early. They don't need to have their breast removed. They can usually have what we call a lumpectomy, which removes the area where the cancer is. And then the rest of their breast or a portion of their breast can be treated with radiation, and they can be left functionally intact without losing their breast and with a good prognosis. And for many of these breast cancer patients, chemotherapy or hormonal therapy will also be part of the treatment to help reduce the risk of the cancer spreading.
So all in all, I'm feeling pretty upbeat at the end of this conversation. What words of hope do you have for people out there with cancer?
Technology is getting better. The ability to treat cancer patients with being less invasive is getting better. Find a team of people that is experienced, and your outcomes nowadays are going to be significantly better than they ever were before, and there's a lot to be hopeful about.
Thank you, Dr. Harrison. It's been a distinct pleasure to have with me this past hour Lewis B. Harrison, Clinical Director of Continuum Cancer Centers of New York and Chairman of Radiation Oncology at Beth Israel Medical Center and St. Luke's and Roosevelt's Hospital in New York City. I hope he's enlightened you on the advances in radiation as it is used in the treatment of cancers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Philip Stieg is the chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College and neurosurgeon-in-chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Ken Ipp is our producer. The executive producer is Alan Chartok. Our audio engineer is Adam Claremont. Production support for How to Save Your Life comes from the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. How to Save Your Life is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.